Hachette Audio presents Robert Ludlum's The Bourne Initiative, written by Eric Van Lustbader, read by Holter Graham. For Victoria, my one and only, my everything. Prologue. Somalia Coast, Horn of Africa. There is something about a man on his knees, Kyr thought, that stirs my very heart. Kyr, the Somali Magus, a Yibir, whose lineage stretched back through time to the days of the Ajuran Empire, predating all the subsequent failed sultanates, stood on the hard shingle 12 feet from the soft rumble of the Indian Ocean. He breathed in the salt air, the familiar scents of the sear desert behind him, the sun-baked brick of houses destroyed by bazooka blasts and rocket fire. But all these clean scents were at the moment overwhelmed by the stink of human sweat, excrement, and terror. Ah, but terror is what Kyr fed upon, lapped up like mother's milk since he was a child of 8 in the aftermath of his first kill. The first taste of blood was always the sharpest, but for him, the blood didn't matter as much as it did to his compatriots. But then they weren't Ibir, weren't steeped in the Stygian darkness of his family's ancient sorcery. Their nostrils dilated as the fresh blood flowed from the newly dead, but for Kyr, the blood was an adjunct, as necessary as shooting dead the man who, on his knees, waves the white flag. It's the white flag, you see, he told himself. The white flag stinks of fear. I want to inhale its scent, savor its taste before I put a match to it and set it afire. Where he stood now, on the shore of Somalia, between the desert of destruction and the Indian Ocean, on which he often enough plied his particular brand of terror, he was immersed in the stench of death. Before him, 13 men knelt, backs bowed, heads bowed further. Some stared in stony silence at the shingle on which they knelt, its shifting layers slicing like razor blades into their knees. Others wailed their fear in pitiful ululations. One or two had tear streaks along their dust-caked cheeks. None of them murmured a prayer, further confirmation, if any was needed, of what Kyr already knew. He was a tall man, cadaverously thin, all muscle and bone, with a long triangular face and a saturnine countenance. He was both as athletic as a swimmer and as graceful as a dancer, not only strikingly handsome, but possessed of a charisma gifted to very few. He had dedicated himself to many things, not the least of which was creating a dazzling smile that fooled everyone. 13 men, on their knees, bowed down, wrists tied behind their backs. In Kyr's left hand, a large German Mauser, restored to all its World War II glory. Who was its original owner? A member of the Gestapo? Or the Abwehr, maybe, their mortal enemy? What did it matter, anyway? Kyr asked himself. It was his now, unlocked and loaded. Stepping up, he placed the muzzle of the Mauser against the back of the first prisoner's head and pulled the trigger. The sound of the hammer falling was as loud as a thunderclap. As one, the line of men flinched. But there was no detonation. No bullet. Stepping to his right, Kyr placed the muzzle against the back of the second man's head. When he pulled the trigger, the man's head exploded, and what was left of him pitched forward, sprawled awkwardly onto the shingle. Blood, the stench of it rising up to mingle with the terror that, to Kyr's heightened senses, was palpable. Above, black birds wheeled, calling to each other, dinner bells announcing another feast. High above them, the vast sky rippled with clouds, like a weightlifter flexing his muscles. Another step to the right brought him to a spot directly behind the third man in line. Kyr shot him, with more or less the identical result. In all, there were 12 corpses lying face down on the bloody shingle when he reached the end of the line. That left the first man. Kyr had reloaded two-thirds of the way down the line. His Mauser was still itching to inflict more death. He could feel the sensation running up the nerves of his left arm, like the output of a live wire. His hand twitched briefly, in just the way a female lion's paw twitched when she was dreaming of running down an okapi or a gazelle. Jaws at the throat clamping down, blood and viscera overrunning her teeth as the males loped up to feed. Kyr took his time returning to the one remaining kneeling man. He stood in front of him, staring down.
"Look at me," he said.
He could see the man shaking.
"Look at me,"
he said more sharply. The man's head came up. Kyr locked his eyes onto the prisoner's.
"I know who you are," he said,
his tone conversational now.
"I know what you and your kind have been up to. Their death sentence has been carried out, as you can see."
He crouched down so suddenly, the prisoner flinched. He was a thin man, short in stature, but with plenty of upper body strength. He was dark of skin, his nose long and sharp. His brown eyes were set close together, his lips were chapped, the skin flaking off as if he'd been out in the sun too long.
"He's been here with me too long," Kyr thought. "That's for certain."
He stared hard into the other's face as he said,
"Here, your death sentence will be carried out in the blink of an eye."
There were smears of dried blood on the prisoner's cheek. He stank of sweat and terror, and there was about him a certain fecal stench.
"But for you, my friend, that death sentence can be commuted. Your life can continue."
Kyr left it there. It was time to keep silent.
The prisoner's jaw muscles worked spasmodically. His tongue, gray as ash, appeared, then slipped back between his teeth.
"How?"
he asked in a thin, reedy voice. And Kyr knew the man would tell him what he wanted to know. Despite the miasma the man wore like a cloak, Kyr leaned in and said in his ear,
"What I want to know is this. Who do you work for?"
The prisoner's mouth worked as if he was trying to summon up the courage to answer or enough saliva to speak clearly. Before he could say a word, Kyr said,
"His full name and position. Nothing less will save you."
The prisoner swallowed hard. His eyes flicked from one side to the other, as if frightened of being overheard, even out here in the Somalian wilderness.
"Not out loud."
Kyr nodded, giving him permission to lean forward. He placed his lips against the opening of Kyr's ear and whispered six words. Those words, the identity of the man who trained these 13 to infiltrate his cadre, caused a profound change in Kyr's demeanor. His face darkened, his lips compressed, his eyes seemed to cross. Then, in a flash, he turned his head sideways, and with his open jaws and his bared teeth, he ripped the man's throat out.
Part 1. Meme.
Chapter 1. Morgana Roy walked briskly to work at precisely 8:36 in the morning. As a creature of habit, she always walked a mile from the public parking garage to her office in the rear of a half-derelict building on the fly-blown main drag of Bowie, Maryland. Bowie was just southwest of Fort Meade, where the black glass NSA Colossus rose seemingly out of nowhere. As usual, she had arisen at 6 in the morning, driven to the dojo, where she had been a member for 7 years, and worked out vigorously with masters of 2 different martial arts disciplines for more or less 45 minutes each, before showering and changing into her work clothes. Her apartment, 20 miles southwest of the office, would seem to an outsider like a perfectly sterile environment. Apart from appliances, there were 2 or multiples thereof of everything. Sofas, chairs, lamps, coffee and side tables, laptop computers at 2 different workstations. On the dining room table stood 2 vases, each equidistant from the center, 6 chairs. Everything was symmetrical.
She lived a compartmentalized life. Order was important to her. Chaos made her uneasy. Though the truth was, she found the concept intriguing. She made this walk in all seasons, all kinds of weather, without fail, and at a speed that would make most others huff and puff and clutch the stitch in their side. There was about this walk something of a challenge, so grueling in summer heat and winter sleet, that those who occasionally had to walk with her privately called it the Baton Death March. It was a joke, of course, but a decidedly grim one. Morgana Roy worked in a small suite of offices hard by a gymnasium, and those new to her unit were assaulted by the smells of stale sweat, underarm odor, and worse, which insinuated themselves through the baseboards of the wall that separated the offices from the gym. Twice a week, these would be temporarily overpowered by the acrid stench of Lysol and bleach. Morgana seemed unaware of these odious smells, or perhaps she had become accustomed to them. Using a magnetic key card, she passed through the door marked with a small, discreet sign, Meme LLC, printed on a sheet of plain white paper. It looked as unsettled as Morgana's state of mind, and in bad weather it had to be replaced almost daily. Still, there was no plan for anything permanent to take its place. Across the street was the smallest post office Morgana had ever seen, a tiny brick building with a sadly draped banner, Rent a P.O. Box Today, hanging off the iron railing of the cement handicap ramp. At Morgana's entrance, a heavyset young woman of 23 in a distinctly non-government-issue gabardine suit got up from behind a desk, said good morning, and went to fetch them both cappuccinos. Good morning, Rose, Morgana said when Rose returned. Beside Rose's desk, a rubber plant's leaves shone as if polished daily. To the right was a cabinet, closed and locked, that in fact contained nothing at all. To the left stood a row of three chairs that had never been sat on, a low table on which were scattered copies of Vanity Fair and Wired, never read, but nevertheless kept current. There were never any visitors to Meme LLC. Ever. At 30, Morgana was the oldest member of the crew. She had 7 people working for her in the office, 7 more out in the field. All of them were young and ruthless. They had, to a person, lean and hungry looks, which was just the way she wanted them. There were 2 doors in the wall behind Rose. The one on the right led to a break room, complete with a refrigerator freezer, a 2-burner stove, a sink, food cabinets, a coffee bean grinder, and the cappuccino espresso maker. Farther along lurked a warren of storerooms that eventually led to a basement. The left-hand door was locked with a retina recognition system. Morgana, cappuccino in hand, looked into the display, opening the door. She took a judicious sip of her cappuccino before stepping across the threshold. She entered a large, windowless room. Across the left wall was a mosaic of LED flat panel screens, but instead of showing feeds of CCTV cameras in airports and street corners in cities around the world, or images of desert encampments relayed from various drones, these screens contained images from computer terminals, hard drive data folders, dynamic malware firewalls. The images kept changing, often so fast they became a blur. Most of the writing on the screens was in Russian Cyrillic or Mandarin Chinese, but there was one in Persian, others in Hebrew and Arabic, still another in Urdu, a final one in Pashto. The right-hand wall was a 4K video loop of aerial footage of the Swiss Alps. An hour from now, it would be seen shot from a boat prowling the Maldives, and the hour after that, the crowded streets of Midtown Manhattan, and so forth. No one ever complained about the lack of windows. No one looked up when Morgana strode in, which was just the way she liked it. Her cadre of 6 had eyes and minds glued to their laptop screens. There were no partitions between workstations. Thick cables rose from each station to tracks hung just below the ceiling, which allowed Morgana's staff to move around at will, huddle together for impromptu conferences, exchange vital information in real time. Everything on the flat panels was in real time. Real time meant everything to the operators of Meme LLC. Being current was their currency. Morgana fostered a cluster method of cryptanalysis, hence the screens. All MEME's projects were collaborative efforts. This led not only to one success after another, but to a close-knit comradeship among the team impossible to achieve inside the federal government's myriad clandestine services. Morgana passed through a narrow door set discreetly in the far wall. There was no nameplate beside it. This was Morgana's sanctum. From here, she could monitor everything that went on in the outer room. She also had the freedom to turn it all off, and in the semi-darkness, contemplate algorithms and her future. Setting her cappuccino down at her workstation, she removed her jacket, slung it over the back of her ergonomic task chair, sat down. The moment she did so, the screen on her laptop flared to life. Her thumbprint was scanned, and she was in. There was the usual slew of email messages waiting in her box, but there was also one that was flagged. Uh-oh, she thought. Blackstar. She knew what Blackstar meant, and it wasn't usual in any way, shape, manner, or form. She clicked on the icon. Instead of opening the message, she was taken directly to the office of General Arthur McQuarrie. His wind-burned, time-lined face filled the screen. His baby blues stared out of the screen as if he were Doctor Strange, who, along with Wonder Woman, was one of her favorite comic book heroes. The analogy was apt. Her boss at NSA was something of a magician. How he kept her unit secret from the Mandarins floating at the top of the governmental alphabet soup, NSA, CIA, DIA, FBI, DOD, DHS, you name it, was a complete mystery to her. And that was only the top layer of his ledger domain. MEME was well-funded. There wasn't one thing Morgana had ever asked for that the general had ever refused. They had bleeding-edge technology to the point where all their equipment was upgraded twice a year. Obtaining vast sums of money from Marshall Fulmer, former senator and head of the Joint Armed Services Appropriations Committee, JSAC, who had just been confirmed by Congress as the incoming president's national security advisor, without letting on what the funds were for, seemed an impossibility. And yet the general managed it. "Morning, Mac," she said, as she took another sip of her cappuccino. "What's up?" The general was possessed of a wide brow and beetling eyebrows. One could tell a lot from those eyebrows, which were the most mobile aspect of his diamond-shaped face.
"It seems our old friend Boris Ilyich Karpov has climbed out of the grave."
"General Karpov is dead," Morgana said. "His throat was slit from ear to ear in Moscow last year at his wedding."
"And yet, he keeps bedeviling us."
The general shook his head.
"As you were well aware, Boris Karpov trod a fine line between doing the sovereign's bidding and working for himself. That is more difficult in Russia than it is anywhere else in the world save North Korea. It seems that in the months before he was killed, Karpov was working on several clandestine initiatives."
Morgana's screen split. McQuarrie remained in the left half, while the right half was filled with a rain of vertical lines of computer code so complex they took her breath away. "What in the name of holy hell is that?"
"No idea," McQuarrie said, "which is why I brought it to you."
"We'll get right on it."
"That's just what you won't do," McQuarrie said. "This is for your eyes only. No one is to see or even catch a whiff that this code exists. Got that?"
"Of course. But what do you think it is?"
The general seemed to age a decade before her eyes. He ran a hand across his face, and to her horror, she noticed a slight tremor in the fingers. "My best guess? A cyber weapon. Something so sophisticated that it's far beyond anything we've seen or even dreamt of before. For some time, this thing, this weapon, was a rumor, nothing more. But because some of the stories attributed fantastic powers to it, I kept my ear to the ground, collated even the most outlandish of the rumors. And then out of the blue, an hour ago, this shard appeared in the wild. My people found it quite by accident while trolling the dark web for intel on a certain arms dealer we've been after for years, but have yet to pin a single misstep on, let alone a crime. When leads do surface, the people behind them vanish as if into thin air. We never even find a body."
"What's this arms dealer's name?"
"Kyre.
He's a Somali pirate, or was, anyway, until we took Victor Bout into custody.
She knew Bout was the most notorious illegal arms dealer of the last decade.
That left a giant hole in the illegal arms trade, and Kyr was first into Bout's territory, killing off whoever was left from the Russians' own network, replacing them with his own people. Kyr has proven himself to be smarter, better connected, and far more slippery than Bout ever was. The story goes that his network is larger, more far-flung, and most crucially, contains contacts inside governments worldwide. Bout had customs and immigration people in a dozen countries in his pocket. By contrast, Kyr's network makes Bout's look like a kindergarten class. Whether that's the Emmis, I don't yet know, but it's this cyber weapon that's giving me a migraine for the ages. You need to make sense of the fragment, and you have to find the rest of the code.
Morgana sat back, absorbing the information Mac was throwing her way. Something was nagging at her, and she voiced it. Mac, have you thought about why this fragment suddenly showed up on the dark web?
What do you mean?
There are any number of ways. No, there aren't. Not something of this level of sophistication. No, Mac, my guess is that it was released on the dark web deliberately.
But what for?
I think it's a strong possibility that whoever took possession of the cyber initiative following Karpov's murder is putting it up for auction.
Auction?
What better way to whet potential buyers' appetites and drive up their bids than to let them take a peek behind the curtain, so to speak?
Christ, I hadn't thought of that.
McQuarrie was sweating now, droplets forming at his hairline, rolling down the sides of his cheek. Could this Kyr be running the auction?
Possible. Even likely. Somalia is just the place for such things.
The general frowned.
But I'm thinking he's only the conduit. Someone else is the mastermind. And knowing Karpov as I did, it would have to be someone he trusted implicitly as well as explicitly.
That rules out just about everyone in the Russian government, doesn't it? McQuarrie nodded.
Yes, it does.
Someone from within the initiative itself, then.
Again, knowing Karpov, he wouldn't trust anyone like that with the big picture. His operations were meticulously compartmentalized. That was his first rule of keeping his work absolutely secure. No one could betray him if they didn't know what was really going on.
In that case, I'm willing to bet several people wrote this code, each one unaware of what the others were doing. Could Karpov himself have stitched all the pieces of code together?
The general was a man of many talents, McQuarrie said. It's possible, I suppose, but frankly, not very likely.
Well, no programmer could direct Karpov's initiative as a whole. The best ones are like idiot savants. They know their stuff backward and forward, but that's all they're good for. They couldn't direct themselves out of a paper bag. She pursed her lips. So again, I have to ask, who is running the operation now? McQuarrie did not answer right away. It seemed to Morgana that now they had come to the nub of the matter. His face had gone even grayer. Perhaps it was the lighting in his office, but she doubted that. His right eyebrow twitched, which meant he was under extreme stress. What could cause such a thing? She asked herself.
One thing before we go any further, Morgana.
She said nothing. Even for her, who was more or less inured to such things, waiting for the second shoe to drop was a mighty unpleasant experience. This was General Arthur McQuarrie, not some fatuous NSA type who didn't know his ass from his elbow.
I have no doubt that Karpov's operation is aimed squarely at the United States.
He paused to wipe at a growing film of sweat on his upper lip.
It could be the National Electrical Grid, or even, God forbid, the President's Bank of Nuclear Missile Codes.
What? But that's impossible. The code data is buried so deeply behind a phalanx of firewalls, and then the codes are changed hourly.
All true. But Karpov's operational language is so obscure, so utterly unknown, I and my people believe the nuclear codes are its target.
If the Russians access our nuclear codes,
you see the nature of the extreme danger we're in.
Morgana stared at the lines of code cascading down her screen. Good God, she thought. What we have here is the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. Black Star. No wonder.
This is a superworm, she said. A form of malware no one's ever encountered before.
Tell me something I don't know.
This is catastrophic. You had better come up with the answer, stat. Morgana didn't like the tone that had set into his voice. This had happened more than once before, when Max started treating her like a low-level gopher, his voice hard and threatening. She bit her lip, but bile built up in her stomach, churning as if a whirlpool had opened up inside her.
Horrifyingly, there's more, Mac was saying.
She tensed even more as the code vanished, to be replaced by a grainy black-and-white photo, obviously taken with a telephoto lens. A surveillance shot, then. Men in tuxedos, women in fancy floor-length gowns, jewels and beading glittering. Over their heads, an ornate crystal chandelier spilling light down on them.
Moscow,
McQuarrie gave her a date from last year,
on the occasion of Boris Karpov's wedding.
I see Karpov, Morgana said, in the center.
Do you recognize anyone else?
He has his arm across the shoulders of the man to his immediate right. Yes.
Do you recognize that man?
She leaned closer, zoomed in a bit, but not too much. The images would become too vague to accurately glean features and expressions. I'm afraid I don't, Mac. The general sighed.
Well, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised.
She felt the whirlpool congeal into an icy ball. She wanted to vomit it up and throw it at Mac. Instead, fighting to keep her cool, she said, Karpov looks genuinely pleased to be with him. But as you've told me, he didn't have any close friends in the Russian hierarchy.
That's correct.
Now she was sure that McQuarrie was in serious distress. His eyebrows were knit together in a dreadful expression of anxiety.
That man isn't a Russian, Morgana. He's one of ours, or at least he was.
You're looking at Boris Karpov's best friend, the only one he would trust to continue his operation in the event of his demise. The man Karpov is embracing is Jason Bourne. Chapter 2. The Aegean Sea was a pure cobalt blue in the late afternoon sunlight. The boat plowed through the waves on its way west. Nim, Boris Karpov's 100-foot motorboat, whose captain and crew were Greeks and Cypriots, was the only asset of the late FSB general that hadn't been confiscated by the Russian government following his murder and the death of his new bride. The only reason it hadn't been confiscated was that Boris had wisely kept the boat in international waters, out of reach of even the sovereign's avaricious clutches. These thoughts were uppermost in Jason Bourne's mind as he stood amidships, leaning on the polished port railing, staring at the smudge on the horizon that even at this distance he recognized as the island of Skiros. To the northeast, and days behind them, was the Sea of Marmara, and beyond, Istanbul, where they had briefly anchored to take on supplies, fuel, fresh food, and water. Istanbul was no longer a safe haven for Westerners, and yet he knew so many people in and around the city that he, rather than the captain, did all the bartering. From Skiros, he had no idea where he would go. At the moment, he was content to be at sea, to feel salt wind in his hair, to have it cleanse him of Boris's horrific murder and its exhausting and perilous aftermath. Boris had been involved in a myriad of strategies, initiatives of which neither the sovereign nor his comrades in the FSB were aware. Perhaps they will all unravel now, or even had already died along with the spymaster who had conceived them. It was a relief not to have to think of tomorrow, of ticking clocks, of countdowns towards one catastrophe or another, of outrunning life or deadly deadlines. His best friend was gone, had left him the boat as a remembrance. In truth, he had no use for this huge boat. Nevertheless, here he was. It was a matter of honoring both his friendship and Boris's memory to accept the gift, to use it as he saw fit. Boris trusted him to do that. He had every intention of respecting that trust. Behind him, too, was the Russian Federation. Last year, he had fallen so deeply into a nest of vipers, he'd be quite happy never to set foot in Russia again. All this brooding about the past, the part of it he could remember, was making him melancholy. But what else should he feel? Every time he thought he'd had enough, that he should return to the professional life of David Webb, the person he had been before the Bourne identity had been imprinted on him by the people running Treadstone, he knew it was useless. He'd tried that, twice in fact, only to become bored within weeks. He was who he was now. He couldn't outrun it. Senseless to try. The Nim slowed to quarter speed. Captain Stavros appeared out of the wheelhouse, descended an outside ladder, and approached Bourne. He carried a bottle of chilled vodka, two glasses, and a pepper shaker.
Berth or anchorage?
He asked, in his typical shorthand. In the days since Bourne had come aboard Nim, the two men had come to know each other as much as two strangers in close quarters can know each other. They ate their meals together, drank together, afterward exchanged stories about the boat's former master, for whom Stavros had a deep and abiding affection. Despite his formidable personality, his studied cruelty, Boris had often been astonishingly genial. Despite his dark and brooding Russian soul, or perhaps because of it, he had loved good food, fine drink, and laughter. Lots of laughter. The perfect anodyne for the bleak profession he had carved out for himself. Boris had felt things deeply, made friends for life, would do anything for those friends. These qualities, mirrored in Bourne, had formed the basis of their abiding friendship. Even though they often found themselves on opposite sides, many were the times they helped each other out, finding common enemies to defeat. Bourne would miss their camaraderie, but he missed the heightened experience of shared danger, most of all. Anchorage. Bourne gave him coordinates, and Stavros nodded. He was used to being told the minimum about where his master was headed and why. Handing Bourne one of the glasses, he gave them both generous pours of the vodka, a very fine Russian brand, Bourne noted. Before they drank, Stavros dotted the surface of the liquor in each glass with pepper. He grinned at Bourne, who returned the expression. This was a silent tribute to Boris, an old-school Russian, if ever there was one. Back in the day, you always used pepper before you drank your vodka. Often, the liquor would contain fusel oil, a product of poor distillation. The pepper would bind with the oil, sink it to the bottom of the glass. The word fusel, Bourne knew, was German for bad liquor.
To our great general,
Stavros cried, holding his glass high. His voice was a deep basso, clotted by years of too much drink and cigarette tar. To Boris Ilyich. Long may his memory live on, Bourne thought.
We will never forget him.
They clinked glasses, downed the vodka in one. Above them, the sky was an inverted porcelain bowl, light blue and white, the colors of the boat's master stateroom. Gulls wheeled and called plaintively, having flown out from the island's rocky cliffs on the eastern shore to beg for food.
Will we be staying in Skiros long?
Several days, Bourne said evasively, and the captain nodded, understanding. It was none of his business. He refilled Bourne's glass, then took his leave, heading back up into the wheelhouse to guide Nim the last half mile to the anchorage 200 yards offshore. The water was quite deep on this side of the island. Bourne moved toward the bow, the better to watch the craggy cliffs and the curved shingle coming into focus. Details, he thought. Everything was in the details. So many of his foes had forgotten to take care of the details. So many had lost their lives because of that lapse. Bourne called for the speedy runabout with its overclocked dual diesels. As he descended the accommodation ladder, he saw the captain staring down at him.
Sure you don't want one of the crew with you, sir?
Positive. Stavros held up a Steyr M automatic pistol in a sign of query.
Thanks, but there's no need.
You never know.
Stavros grinned.
The general used to say that.
True enough. Bourne raised a hand, caught the Steyr, then made his way down to the waiting runabout. The captain had dropped anchor at the precise coordinates Bourne had given him. Bourne had been to Skiros only once, and that under extreme conditions. But in light of what was about to take place, he supposed his return could be considered a homecoming of sorts. The crewman who had been preparing the runabout for him leapt up onto the accommodation ladder and cast off. Bourne fired up the outboard engine and headed to a spot just left of the headland that jutted out into the Aegean like a questing nose. Gulls peeled away from the boat, circled him for a while, then wheeled away, calling their disappointment. When he was close enough for the runabout to enter the shadow of the looming promontory, he steered it farther left. By this point, the headland was between him and the Nim. No one on board could see what he was doing, or who was waiting for him. She was sitting on a rise on the shingle, smoking a cigarette, watching him beneath half-lowered lids as he cut the engines, dropped anchor, and leapt into the shallows. She made no move to help him, stayed where she was, giving him that peculiar sideways glance of hers as he picked his way up the shingle to her. She wore a revealing swimsuit of a metallic, plum-colored fabric. She was turned so that he could see the ugly scar that ran along the outside of her right calf all the way up to her hip bone. It was clear the wound had been inflicted in many stages, a form of torture. He knew what had been carved into her beautiful back. Her magnificent legs were very long, her waist thin. A scattering of freckles dusted the bridge of her nose. Her eyes changed color with the light, either midnight blue or black. In all, she was staggeringly beautiful.
Do you think what I'm wearing is appropriate?
For the beach, you mean?
She smiled a 1,000-watt smile. They were more or less repeating their lines from last year when they had met in Nicosia. Before that, Bourne hadn't seen her since he had spirited her away from Kyr's camp in Somalia. She had been younger then, no more than a girl. But Kyr had spent months torturing her, indoctrinating her as dictated by his Ibir traditions. What he had meant to do with her, Bourne had no idea, and if she knew, she had never told him. Her name was Mala Ilves, an Estonian by birth. No one but Bourne called her Mala now. Few even knew the name. These days, she was known only as the Angel Maker.
For what we are here to do, she said.
How can I answer? I don't know why you asked me to come here, to such an out-of-the-way place. She turned her face up to the lowering sun.
It's peaceful here, isn't it?
That sideways glance again.
But it's also bloody.
That was a long time ago, Mala.
Not for me, it isn't.
She ran her fingertips down the length of the scar.
It's only yesterday.
Bourne came and sat down beside her. I don't believe that. She smelled of licorice and the sea and clean sweat. A far cry from the stench of blood and rotting flesh that rose off her when he had brought her here from Somalia. She ran her hands through her thick hair.
I've never lied to you, Jason.
How many times have you wanted to? She wet her lips with the tip of a pink tongue and laughed softly.
I cannot count the times.
He waited a moment before he spoke again. Sunlight glanced off the waves, spreading the last of its warmth toward them. A cormorant vanished from sight, returned to the surface a good 3 yards away with a silvery fish in its beak. Lifting its head to the sun, as Mala had, it swallowed the fish whole. So tell me, why have you brought me here?
Are you in such a rush? Do you have somewhere to go? Or someone to see?
The last was not a question, and a tiny curl of warning reared its head in the pit of his stomach. How much did she know about his recent life? Perhaps everything. He knew he would have to begin with that assumption and work his way back to the truth. One thing he would never do is underestimate her. Everyone who had made that mistake was dead.
No,
he said. I'm all yours. That sideways glance and a sly smile. Did she believe him? Or was she as wary of him as he was of her?
You belong to no one, Jason. Not even the Israeli.
So she did know about Sarah. He was angry. It felt like a violation of his private life, but he was not surprised. There had never been anything about Mala that honored privacy. All of that had been systematically stripped from her by Kyre. Lacking her own boundaries, she observed none in others. Is that why you brought me here? Out of jealousy? His tone was bantering. Nevertheless, his question contained a sub rosa strata of intention.
Would that be so bad?
She leaned against him, her skin warm, the pulse of blood beneath like a song.
But then, I'm a bad girl. No one knows that better than you.
The ones who knew that better than me are all dead. She laughed.
Yes, I suppose that's true.
She slid her leg against his. More warmth as the sun began to melt into the western horizon.
There is no time but time.
He knew what she meant by that. Time was what you made of it, how you apportioned it, what you trained yourself to remember and to forget. Is that why he couldn't remember any further back, beyond the point when he'd been shot and pitched into the Black Mediterranean? He had almost died then. Or was there an incident far worse, so dreadful that his mind had blocked it out of self-preservation? Something even worse than what Mala had been through. What if he never knew? What if it was better for him not to know? But not knowing was a purgatory in and of itself.
Poor Jason, a man without a history,
she said, as if reading his mind.
At least I know who my parents were.
And how much has that helped you?
Ouch, right, needling each other is not such a good idea after all.
Then why start?
Because I'm the scorpion.
She meant the old story. A scorpion found itself on the wrong bank of a river. It asks a frog to carry it on its back across the river. The frog wisely says, "But you'll sting me." The scorpion replies with perfect logic, "Why would I do that? If I sting you, we'll both die." Frogs being logical creatures, it agrees. But halfway across the river, the scorpion stings the frog. As they're both about to drown, the frog cries piteously, "Why?" And the scorpion replies with perfect logic, "I'm a scorpion. It's my nature." Mala shrugged.
"But what do you care? You're no frog."
The failing light seemed to have congealed, and strangely, the island they were on seemed to shrink into the oncoming darkness, the night being dominated by the Black Sea, the high, brittle dome of stars, the rising of the moon, lantern-like, low in the eastern sky. They rose, Mala leading him up the steepening shingle and over a hummock of rock where she had stashed her hiking boots, her striped beach bag, and a midnight blue cover-up, which she shrugged on as they began picking their way up and over the rock face.
"Are you hungry?" she asked.
"We could eat on the boat," he said. "There's a fine chef."
"I already made a reservation,"
which hardly seemed necessary on this isolated spot in the Aegean. Skidos was not a particularly popular tourist destination. A packed earth path appeared before them, wending its way over a rise and down. Soon enough, paving stones heralded the advent of what passed for civilization here. The tavern, when they came upon it, was lit up with strings of electric lights crisscrossing its cement patio, where tables and chairs were strewn as if at random. A smiling Greek greeted them with glasses of retsina and showed them to a table at the lip of the patio. From the edge, the falloff was steep, and they had a picture-perfect view down past the promontory on their right to the cove off which the Nim, lights ablaze, lay at anchor.
That's some legacy your friend left you,
Mala commented as she settled into her chair.
He must have had many millions of petrodollars stashed away.
Bourne stared at her. Was she deliberately baiting him again, or was she just making idle chatter? Either way, he didn't care for the topic. Food came, lots of it. Presumably, she had pre-ordered. Everything was sea-fresh and delicious. She did not look at him while they ate, staring out at the mysterious night, as if waiting for a communication only she could hear. As it turned out, she was momentarily at a loss as to how to broach a subject she knew would be delicate, would raise any number of red flags for him. She waited until the plates had been cleared, coffee and more retsina served, and they were once again alone in the night.
Your friendship with the late General Karpov has caused consternation, not to mention anger, in a number of quarters.
He stared at her, silent, wondering where this was going. Fireflies danced in the shrubbery. Moonlight turned the rocks a metallic silver. The crash of surf against the shore was a dim rumble running up the hill toward them. She smirked, reached into her bag, drew out an 8x10 blow-up, which she placed before him.
You never should have accepted Karpov's invitation to his wedding. There you are, for all the world's clandestine organizations to see, with the general's arm slung across your shoulders. Bosom buddies? That's the phrase, isn't it? She laughed. The Japanese would say huckleberry friends, but they get all these odd translations from American pop songs.
She meant, in this case, Moon River.
Jason, in all seriousness, this photo has caused a hornet's nest of angst within your own secret services. And as for the FSB, now that the general is gone, now that Timur Savasin discovered you made off with Ivan Volkin's ill-gotten gains, the First Minister is also out for your blood.
Someone's always out for my blood.
And what about your Israeli inamorata?
Bourne briefly thought about not answering her, but then realized that might be just what she wanted. She met Boris several times.
Enemies or friends?
Boris Ilyich was not like that. If you knew him,
a little late for that, isn't it?
He was about to go when she put her hand over his.
Sorry.
She looked him straight in the eye.
Really?
Still, he remained half risen.
She lowered her voice. You know, every wound, every scar, you know how hideous my body is.
Bourne sat back down. Which is what makes me sad.
You see,
she flared.
I knew it!
Mala, you misunderstand me. What Kyr did to you, the rituals he performed on you, you became his, but that doesn't have to be. You're stronger than that.
But as you see, I'm here with you, now, jealous of your Israeli, who I am certain possesses a flawless body.
Bourne was determined to say nothing more on this subject. She sighed.
I suppose I feel possessive of you, our history. And then, there's what you've done for Lys.
Then the two of you have spoken, at least. Mala shook her head.
I tried, but Lys won't speak to me.
What happened? She was hoping you'd make one of her performances.
I did. I was in New York in the winter when she performed at Lincoln Center.
And you didn't come backstage to see her?
We're not cut from the same cloth. I'm death to her. I won't come near her.
Then he understood. That was when she had seen him with Sarah. He frowned. How long have you been surveilling me? She pursed her lips.
I strive to know as much about you as you know about me.
But you never can.
It doesn't stop me from trying.
And she tossed her head again.
Oh, come on. I have no evil designs on you, Israeli.
Sarah.
Her name is Sarah,
Bourne thought. He had met the Mossad agent 5 years ago, had saved her life in Mexico City, had worked with her on and off since then. Last year, she had been falsely accused of murdering Boris. The idea of speaking her name in Mala's presence, of hearing her say it, seemed intolerable. These were two separate areas of his life. Instinct told him that bringing them together in any form was a recipe for disaster. "Who do you have evil designs on?" he said, wanting to steer the conversation in another direction.
"The people who are now out to terminate you with extreme prejudice, and I do mean extreme."
"It's been tried before."
"I know, but this is different."
"How?"
"The Americans and the Russians are coming after you simultaneously. If you're not careful, they'll have you in the pincer movement, west and east, converging on one target."
He considered this for a moment. "So you brought me here to warn me?" She nodded.
"Partly. And partly to—"
At that instant, the Nim was consumed by a series of oily fireballs. The rolling thunder of the detonations reached them seconds after the boat was engulfed. And then its fractured components spewed high in the air, an infernal fountain. Chapter 3.
Have they found anything?
Nothing, sir.
First Minister Timur Savasin, second only to the sovereign himself, stood on the grounds of Boris Ilyich Karpov's dacha, in the dense woods north of Moscow, hands on hips, sucking on a cigarette stuck in the corner of his mouth. In front of him, a squad of men were digging, burrowing, banging on walls and floorboards, checking for false backs in cupboards, secret niches under the stairs. In other words, tearing the interior apart. Off to his left, a bulldozer sat idling, while its operator smoked a cigarette. Behind that was the huge flatbed that had transported the machine out here from Moscow.
"No money, no logbooks, no lists, not a fucking thing," he asked in a voice made brittle by frustration.
"No, sir."
He was answered by Igor Malachev, a Kremlin silovik, who was his second in command. Karpov had muscled his way to become the head of both the FSB, the successor to the Soviet KGB, and FSB 2, the anti-narcotics organization. Never again would one man wield such power. The sovereign had purged all of Karpov's people from the 9 FSB directorates. As for FSB 2, that posting was still vacant. The appointment had come as a shock to Savasin. He had not spoken to Konstantin in 5 years. Perhaps this was the sovereign's attempt at a path to a rapprochement. On the other hand, it was just as likely the sovereign's way of pointing out to both men who really pulled the strings in the Russian Federation. General Karpov had gotten far too powerful, right under the sovereign's nose. Clever Karpov had found a way to game the system. That kind of clandestine disobedience would never happen again. The sovereign's action had made that perfectly clear. Either way, having to deal with Konstantin on an almost daily basis returned to Savasin the old, ugly, and humiliating nightmares. However, with the sovereign's blessing, Savasin had elevated Colonel Alex Volodorsky to head of Spetsnaz, the FSB's special forces. He had named Konstantin Ludmirovich to head the FSB.
"All right.
Go ahead and bulldoze the fucker."
"Really?
It's such a beautiful dacha."
Savasin laughed under his breath. Malachev was so transparent. One of his assets, as far as Savasin was concerned. "Keep the reins tight on your horses. Feed them only oats you grow yourself," his father had taught him. The old man might have been cruel, might have loved his vodka a bit too much, but he was no one's fool. It was a good lesson for Malachev to learn. Seeing the dacha he coveted leveled, and he himself giving the order for its destruction. Afterward, in the plush back seat of the armor-plated limousine transporting them back to Moscow Center, Malachev said,
"Sir, what was it exactly you were looking for?"
Savasin sat back, thinking that if it were Karpov sitting next to him, after having searched a rogue general's dasha. He would already know the answer. But then Karpov was nobody's lapdog, not even the sovereign's. That son of a bitch did whatever the hell he pleased, including marrying a Ukrainian with dissident ties. Clever people like him had no business wielding so much power in the Federation. They were far too dangerous. He sighed now, staring out at the blurred landscape, which was becoming more muscular with brutalist buildings shoulder to shoulder like staunch Russian soldiers the closer they got to the ring road that girdled the metropolis. It seems that the general had any number of secret initiatives he was commanding before he died.
Without the sovereign's knowledge.
Malachev seemed shocked. But was he really? Savasan asked himself. Precisely. I am assured we've dismantled them all.
Why do I sense the other shoe is about to drop?
You're right, Savasan said smugly. General Karpov's best friend, the American Jason Bourne, was in country several times over the last year.
He was at the general's wedding, I recall.
The First Minister nodded.
Indeed. But he returned later on, around the time that Ivan Volkin died. I have no doubt Bourne murdered him and took with him an enormous amount of money I believe Karpov had stolen from who knows where.
So Bourne is ground zero for answers,
Malachev said, finally getting with the program.
There is no question in my mind.
Savasan shifted from one buttock to another to ease a cramp in his calf.
Which is why I would dearly like to dispatch a Wimpel Spetsnaz death squad to take Bourne out. If we only knew where he was. With his termination, we will finally be able to bury the last of Boris Ilyich Karpov.
That's Volodarsky's bailiwick,
Malachev pointed out.
I've warned you about him.
Stop,
Savasan had taken out his mobile. Volodarsky has assured me he's close to pinning Bourne's location down. He began to text as they arrived at their destination.
But just in case, Igor, I wish you to make your own inquiries. Discreetly, of course.
Always,
Malachev said, letting himself out. Savasan did not miss the wolfish smile on his second-in-command's face. Françoise Sévigné heard the knock on the hotel room door and, with one last emoji, sent her last text before dropping her mobile into her oversized handbag. Françoise came away from the window overlooking the marina in Kalmar, Sweden. Kalmar was in the southeast of the country, with easy access to the Baltic via the Kalmar Strait, a narrow body of water separating the Swedish mainland from its largest island. She opened the door for Justin Ferreng, a slim, sandy-haired man with a perpetually harried expression. He slipped into the room, and she closed the door after him, double-locking it. He was on her in an instant, his need overwhelming. She welcomed it as a mother welcomes the need of her child, as a totality, as something only she can assuage. He took her up against the wall, as he often did, a breathless time when they made love like war, their clothes rucked, the fabrics rubbing skin to red welts, their voices rising and falling like a tide. The second time was in bed, naked, comfortable, and comforting. Slower, but also fierce, in the way they threw each other around, like wrestlers grappling. Then rest. Perhaps 20 minutes of deep sleep for him. A letting go of anxieties he carried around as a salesman clutches his samples case. The third time was languid. Warm water cascading down on them from the showerhead. He lifted her as easily as he would lift a child, hands cupped against her buttocks, their heat rebuilding itself from glowing embers, heating the water as well as themselves. Steam enveloped them. Later, reclining on the bed, propped up on one elbow, she watched while he dressed.
You're leaving early.
I have a tight schedule. She laughed softly, scrambled over the bed, sat at the foot, legs spread, thrilling to how instantly his gaze was magnetized.
Stay, she said.
I can't. I'm meeting... She spread her thighs further. Their insides were still wet.
A man like you.
Half-dressed, he came toward her, close enough for her to unzip his trousers. She pulled him down on top of her, guided him into her. She stared up into his eyes, but saw nothing of interest. Weeks ago, she had realized there was nothing but shiny surface frosting. What lay beneath was nothing. Nothing at all. Justin had been born into poverty. His father took 6 weeks to die from a factory accident that took his leg and part of his hip. No one could be bothered to reduce his pain, let alone try to save his life. As a consequence, Justin had one holy mother of an axe to grind with the world at large. He was a very determined man. This made him incautious, even reckless, foolish, in other words, though there could be no doubt that in matters of getting his revenge, he was smart as a whip. When they were done, she rolled him off her. Stretching full length, she reached under a pillow. Farang had good reason to feel harried. He was wanted in a number of countries for publishing damning documents hacked off government, corporate, and institutional servers. These leaks had already caused consternation and chaos across the world. Hence, Farang's status as a wanted man. Leakage, Farang's organization, was proudly reliant on third-party whistleblowers, whose identity it protected with the ferocity of a lioness with its cubs. The trouble came in vetting the leakage sources, of which Françoise Sévigné was one. He'd never give her up. She knew that even before the first time she had slipped her arms around him and pressed her body against his, felt his instant arousal. That was 6 months ago, and nothing had changed. His ardor for her burned just as bright. Smiling, she handed him a thumb drive filled with files painstakingly manufactured expressly for him by agents of First Minister Timur Savasin.